You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Executive Vice President of the James Beard Foundation. And every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we have a conversation about taste. Why? Because, well, I mean, duh, taste matters. But also because I think that we don't often, as a culture, spend enough time thinking about the way our food tastes. And I mean that in the broadest sense, that taste isn't just about personal pleasure, that taste isn't just about some sort of notion of connoisseurship, but actually paying attention to the food we eat and the implications of food that can be perceived or filtered through flavor, through our tongues, into our complex brains, where we learned not too long ago from Gordon Shepherd that taste is the most, or eating is the most, is the activity that engages the brain in the broadest, most fundamental way, actually is a good way for us to think about food and for us to think about our culture and who we are and who we want to be. And today we're talking with an old friend who's been on the show before, twice before, although she's now with us in a different capacity, Gabriella Gershenson. Welcome back to the studio here in Bushwick.
Thank you, Mitchell. It's a pleasure to be here, as always.
Last time you were with us, you were with a magazine, many of you know, called Sever. And now you are at a new gig, very new. You are a food writer and editor at Every Day with Rachel Ray magazine. Congratulations on the new job, first
Thank
of all.
Thank you so much.
It's actually the first time we've seen each other, I think, since you've been there.
Do I look different?
You look a little more smiley, maybe, and a little, I don't know, maybe more approachable. I don't know. Let's talk about that.
Less elitist, maybe.
Less elitist. Although one of the things that I think is really interesting, if you don't know this magazine, and there are millions of readers, or more than a million readers.
Millions. I think I was trying to get the numbers down, but it sounds like between newsstand and circulation and everything else, there might be as many as 5 million, but I'm pretty sure circulation is 1.7 million.
Wow. Okay. So that's a lot of people. Not all of them probably different, in fact, from the people who watch the shows of Rachel Ray on TV. I imagine that it's not, there's crossover, but there's more.
I imagine so too. I think by the time you have an empire, there are a lot of people crunching numbers to figure out who's seeing you and who's consuming you and how.
Awesome. So very different, obviously, though, from the niche, the wonderful niche that Sever is, and that sort of quest for the most authentic, the almost unattainable. We travel through the pages of Sever magazine and the photographs and the dishes we may or may not ever make, but can kind of dream about if we even know what they are. Now you find yourself in the midst of a large circulation mass publication, no less dedicated to quality of food or to that taste experience we're talking about. So tell me a little bit about your it's still your first impressions, really. It's only been a couple of weeks.
Yes, it is my first impressions. And first of all, when I was interviewing for the job, I needed to really open the magazine and study it. And I was just so impressed with how many recipes there are. If you open the magazine, it's a really fun index every month. It's a visual index where you can actually see what every single dish looks like that's going to be in these pages. And, you know, the ingredients have a lot of integrity, and there is a lot of practicality and a lot of fun to the cooking that happens in this magazine. And it was funny hearing you talk about authenticity, because something clicked in my mind that, you know, yes, Sever was and is so authentic to, I think, the broader human experience. And Every Day with Rachel Ray is very authentic to what actually happens in my kitchen.
Right.
Because
and to many American kitchens.
Most American kitchens. And absolutely. And it was kind of an interesting transition from a sort of kind of aspirational sense of authenticity to something that really is real. This is a real magazine about what you actually might cook if you find the time or the energy when you come home from work at the end of the day.
Right. So let's talk about that. There's a lot of criticism, I think, about food television in general, because there's the sense that people watch it for entertainment, to use that made-up word, and don't actually cook. But here, a brand made famous on TV, this when you flip through the pages, there's almost nothing but recipes and step-by-step and how-to and understanding, like you said, really what's for dinner, let's say. Can you talk a little bit about the bridge there between watching and doing?
I mean, for me, it's all just, you know, it's me waxing poetic and thinking about the evolution of going from, like you said, food TV, where there were statistics coming out, I think, at the beginning of the aughts about the fact that food TV was wildly popular, but it wasn't translating to people cooking at home because we had the numbers of people watching food TV and the numbers of people buying prepared foods. And, you know, the deductive logic suggested that food TV doesn't make people cook. However, I do know that people buy Every Day with Rachel Ray because they love Rachel. They love her. How did they get to love her? Probably from watching her on the Food Network. But I think that over time, the relationship has transitioned and really brought cooking into the home in a way that perhaps the TV doesn't accomplish, but a magazine does accomplish. Mm-hmm.
Even at the Beard Foundation, where we're known for celebrating the finest, most gifted chefs in the country by inviting them to come cook at the Beard House, when we print the recipes, that's what really gets people excited. We try to find recipes that can be done at home by the average cook or maybe above average cook, but even so, it almost amazes me how the frenzy for recipes, things to cook, hasn't abated, even as so many changes in media and food media have happened and the internet has taken over our lives. We want like 10 or 8 or 5 or 7 ingredients and a few steps, and we really want to make dinner.
Yes, and there's one feature that I absolutely love in the magazine. I'm such a newbie that I'm not even sure I know what we formally call it, although the concept is fantastic. It's basically you go to the supermarket, you buy these 5 ingredients, and here are 3 dishes that you can make with this one set of ingredients. And I just love that because I have to be honest, you know, maybe some people think I'm a spring chicken. I guess I'm still a spring chicken, but I'm feeling a little tired lately. You know, magazine work is very hard. And seeing a feature like that, you know, these 5 ingredients, this is what you buy, and these are the dinners you can make with them. It's a far cry from, you know, traveling to Latvia or to Northern Israel and writing about how people cook there, but it is something that gives me a sense of relief that I can make myself a good meal and have choices and really keep it simple.
Interesting. I'm going to remind people listening that if you have questions for Gabriella about cooking, about recipes, maybe not so many questions about Every Day with Rachel Ray magazine while she still tries to figure it all out, you can call us at 718-497-2128. You can also write us emails at info@heritageradionetwork.org, or if you prefer to tweet, we are at Taste Matters HRN. And do write us, even if you're listening to the podcast or to the archive on heritageradionetwork.org. So I just came back from a gathering of chefs and policymakers in Seattle who are interested in moving the needle in food system change, sort of getting better grown, more environmentally sensitively raised foods to more people, issues of social justice. And often one of the things that comes up is that people need to cook. Some people feel very strongly they need to know how food grows, but the cooking piece seems really important in engaging the average consumer, not the foodie necessarily, just the person who is provisioning for their family or whatever, into these larger issues, that cooking somehow is an important educational process. I wonder if you could speak to that a little bit.
Well, I mean, it just seems logical that if you are going to be shopping for your family and you're going to be cooking the food that you're going to be eating, then perhaps you'll be a little more selective about what you put in your body. I think it's easy to defer that decision to someone else if you're not cooking yourself. But once you cook yourself, I agree with you. It seems like it involves you in a greater community. And that's what's interesting about working for a publication that is based around a personality. That people, you know, if they open the magazine and just see what's inside, like I do, when I look at it just as a consumer, I see just a burst of riches when it comes to the kinds of foods I can be cooking. But the gateway to that experience is the person. And And I think that, you know, it's that sense of community that makes people love cooking as well. It's sort of an interesting cyclical.
What do you think it was about, or is about, Rachel Ray's and her personality that resonates so deeply? She's so different from some of the other people we imagine. If you think of Martha Stewart or even Emeril Lagasse, some of Julia Child or James Beard, for that matter, some of the great personalities who lit a fire under some people about their interest in food. But Rachel Ray is different as a consumer and also as an editor at the magazine. What do you think that is?
Well, having observed her over the years, I just feel like one thing that's been so consistent is her lack of pretension. People would criticize her for her acronyms like EVU or for using the word YAMO and still, you know,
say what EVU is.
EVU is extra virgin olive oil, which is our shorthand in the magazine and every recipe that we run.
YAMO is not an acronym. YAMO is just delicious.
It's just this exclamation of culinary ecstasy when you're eating something really, really delicious. I feel like she took a lot of hits over the years, and it seems to me, again, just as a consumer of media, not as someone who ever worked for her until this moment, she just was who she was. You know, unfortunately, not like Paula Deen, I is who I is. Right. I think that she is who she is. I think she genuinely loves food. She never pretended to be a chef. She always said, "I'm a cook," and just stayed very close to what is authentic to her. And I feel that is sort of the recipe for success for an individual, no matter what you're doing. Mm-hmm. But I feel that is one reason why she has so much staying power. And of course, she's a very, very hard worker. But that's more from a business point of view. But you were asking about why people love her. It's that levity, it's that fun, and it's that genuine sense of it's not that serious,
right?
But it can be seriously fun,
right? It is. We are talking about dinner, and it should be good, and it shouldn't really consume your life. Just putting food on the table.
Yes, it's just unpretentious. I mean, you can take any subject and intimidate the hell out of people with it, and I think that some people use food in that way. And I think that with Rachel Ray and her approach to food, it's much more inclusive.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the meat, literally and figuratively, in the magazine. We, at the Beard Foundation, we recently partnered, before your time there, for a feature where chefs who had won our regional James Beard Award, so Best Chef Northwest, Best Chef New York City, were asked for their favorite burgers, and those burgers were sort of, they were competing against each other, and they were sort of chef-y burgers, let's say, you know, with some funky ingredients that you might not normally find, although now that we have an umami burger here, there's, you know, anything's fair game, I guess, in the fast food burger category, and then we did an event to launch our upcoming national festival, Taste America, at the Beard House with some of the chefs making the burgers. And we had Maricel Precia, who did this beautiful, obviously Latin-tinged burger. We had Mike Anthony from Gramercy Tavern, who had a sort of good old juicy, beefy American burger. And we had Tori Miller from L'Etoile in Madison, Wisconsin, I should say. And he just had this juice bomb. He actually ended up winning the competition. It just, you know, dribbled. It was one of those burgers you couldn't contain, you know, you couldn't save your clothes. Talk about burger. Like there's something so American, so in some ways so unpretentious, although burgers made by fancy chefs adds another twist to it. But talk a little bit about that feature. About, you know, do we need burger recipes, or what's the?
Well, there is a burger recipe guaranteed in every single issue of Every Day with Rachel Ray magazine. There is a burger of the month.
Interesting.
So absolutely yes, there's always a place for burgers. But I think that there's a unique challenge to this magazine, which is Rachel Ray is a high power New York woman. She eats at really nice restaurants, and when she goes and travels, she goes to the best places.
Right.
But I think that there is a particular way to communicate that in a magazine that is a quick read and lighthearted and fun. And I think that the approach that the Beard Foundation with the editors Every Day with Rachel Ray took to this sort of burger tournament is kind of the perfect combination of saying, hey, America, you know, here's this completely like perfect canvas for populist food, which is the burger, but it's being totally interpreted by America's top chefs.
Right, and they all no one denied the challenge. You know, that was the funny part. Mike Anthony from Gramercy Tavern actually said that he'd resisted putting a burger on the menu, not so much because he had anything about burgers, he loves them, but because he sources really good meat, buys whole animals, and didn't really want, he wanted his burger to mean something. He didn't just want it to be there because he knew people would order it. And so it became a vehicle for him to express some concerns of his about sustainable meat and needing grass-fed beef and what you do with the other parts that aren't the rib steaks and all that sort of stuff. So for him, it wasn't even just a taste experience, but it really was a much bigger food culture experience, expressing some of his strong values when it comes to ingredients and sourcing and the environment.
Right, because when you put food into the hand of a thoughtful chef like that, and the chefs who represented it was the chefs who had won the regional James Beard Awards, who were the ones who were picking their favorite burgers from the area where they live. But mm-hmm. I feel like, yeah, if you put a simple thing into the hands of a person who is so evolved and so thoughtful in their craft, then you're going to get something really interesting.
Right. And wholly American and yummy. We're going to take a quick break. We're talking with Gabriella Gershenson, who is the food writer and editor at Every Day with Rachel Ray magazine. You're listening to Taste Matters. I'm Mitchell Davis. We'll be right back.
Today's program has been brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm.
Spanning the rolling hills of Vermont's Champlain Valley and easternmost Washington County, New York, 300-acre Consider Bardwell Farm was the first cheese-making co-op in Vermont, founded in 1864 by Consider Stebbins Bardwell himself. Rotational grazing on pesticide-free and fertilizer-free pastures produces the sweetest milk and the tastiest cheese. All of their cheeses are aged on the farm in their extensive system of caves.
Consider Bardwell Farm is also a big supporter of Heritage Foods USA's No Goat Left Behind program. No Goat Left Behind is a serious effort launched in 2011 by Heritage Foods USA, designed to introduce goat meat to American diners and provide a sustainable end market for dairy animals.
For more information, please visit www.considerbardwellfarm.com.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis. Every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, from 11 to 11:30, we have a conversation about taste. Although I think most people actually listen not live, but to our podcast, which is available on iTunes. Or you can also get the entire backlist, nearing 100 episodes, at heritageradionetwork.org in the archive there, under our button for Taste Matters. Today we're talking with Gabriella Gershenson, who has been here before, with whom I have the pleasure of talking about food and sharing meals, breaking bread, often at Breads, a great bakery here in the city, an outpost of a wonderful Israeli bakery. But let's talk about, back to your new gig, this exciting mass place where we can, where you have the possibility to touch millions of people and help, hopefully help them make decisions about what to eat for dinner,
no,
for
no
lunch.
No pressure.
What's coming up that interests you in features and the upcoming issues of the magazine?
Well, September issue is about to hit the newsstands, and I am in love with this one feature. It is all about Italian-American cooking, and that is a topic that to me just never gets old, and It is so dear to people's hearts. I think there's a generation of people who grew up with Italian grandmas who made their Sunday sauce, and I think those people are the people who are now opening restaurants and making magazines and, you know, having cooking shows, because I think there's no... There's no shortage right now of Italian-American inspiration.
You just flipped open the issue and I'm startled by five gigantic cannoli, I should say, filled with all sorts of delicious looking things. So what's the focus of the article or the feature?
It's really just a straight up listicle with recipes and really fun prose. So it's 20 reasons to embrace your inner Italian. And the first reason is all these customizable cannolis. And it's great because not only is there literal food porn, I mean, there's huge images of cannolis taking up the whole page, but there are also recipes. So we're highlighting the Spritz, which is one of my favorite cocktails of all time, which is Prosecco and Campari and some orange slices and ice. We have chefs from all over the country who make Italian food, just talking about their favorite pasta dish of all time.
So let's Italian and Italian American. Let's look at that a little bit. I'm spending a lot of time talking to folks in Italy, and they mean different things. They're very different things, and they certainly have different cultural resonances. I think for even diehard foodies, but also just American eaters in general. What thoughts about that?
I'm not Italian and I'm not an expert. However, I do have some opinions.
Of course you do.
Of course. There's a book that I used as a reference many years ago by a woman named Hassia Diner. Oh. And she wrote about immigrant foodways. And she wrote about what Italians, how they kind of...
She's coming on the show.
Really?
In the future. We're trying to get her. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, her book kind of changed my life.
And the book is Hungering for America.
Hungering for America. Yeah. And it really resonated with me. She was writing about these Italians who they heard from the new country that you can have beer with every meal and you can eat meat every day. And these are people who are subsisting, on what we now call like a local seasonal kind of locavore diet, but they were eating mostly grains and vegetables and they were really poor.
And hungry.
Right. And then they come to America and there are these wonderful accounts from letters that people wrote back to the old country of all of the food they ate, and they put all their disposable income practically into food and eating. So I think that sense of abbondanza in this kind of new world celebration is something that exists in Italian American cooking. I can't speak as much to Italian cookery because, I think that's something that you could really speak to. But in terms of that, the manifestation of immigrant dreams coming to America and that dream having so much to do with food and with abundance, I think that really informs what Italian American mm-hmm. cooking is.
That's interesting. I also think one of the challenges in some of the issues we were talking about earlier, the whether we're talking about obesity or food justice or that kind of thing, have to do with the cultural resonances of abundance and what America meant, generations ago for immigrants, but even for immigrants today, that you can't just negate the land of plenty idea. It isn't, regardless of what needs to happen, what's going on in the planet, in the larger sphere, the idea of America is very compelling for many people and for many reasons. And how do you stop that? You have to be sensitive, I think, to the cultural components of that.
Well, there's the whole it's an iconic cliche probably of the Russian immigrant coming to America and passing out when they walk into the supermarket because of all of the food and all of the choice. And my parents are Russian immigrants, and my cousin's first job when he immigrated here in the 90s from the former Soviet Union was at McDonald's.
Wow.
Food is definitely a part of the American dream, just in different ways for different people. But one thing that occurred to me also as we were talking about Italian-American cooking is love and family. Mm-hmm. You can't divorce that from the abundance that was experienced by people who came here when they didn't have enough and suddenly mm-hmm. their money can buy them so much. It also had to do with who they were with and who they were cooking for. And I think that is another component of Italian-American cooking, just the love inherent in it that really transfers, even if you're talking about a meatball sub. There's just some kind of warmth in that meatball sub. It's just part of its DNA.
Right. So as someone who's now worked at two incredibly popular and important magazines and also written for many other publications, let's talk a little bit about the media landscape out there. Over the last 10, I mean, you could say 5, you could say 20 years, but the change in media has been drastic, from the loss of major newspapers, the loss of Gourmet magazine, which was such an icon for so long. And yet there's still, as you mentioned earlier, this desire to flip the pages and see pretty pictures of food and be inspired by recipes, even while you have an app, cookbooks on your iPhone and you go, you Google whatever to find a dish to cook. Could you talk a little bit about what you think the landscape looks like? And
I think something interesting happened with food. I think there are a lot of factors involved with the way food is growing right now. One is that just naturally during this whole transition in the media world, I also feel there's been that American food revolution where people are really expressing themselves politically through food. They're expressing themselves in an entrepreneurial way through food. They're redefining who we are as a country through food, whether it's from, you know, the fad of pickling and trying to do things the way grandma did in a pre-industrial way, to, you know, reviving heirloom crops. That's all happening. And then there is this very populist opportunity on the web of blogs. And I feel that people really jumped in and created a community for food on the web that has created a very nice synergy with a kind of DIY and just in general much more involved and engaged public when it comes to food. So I think it's a complicated question and there's a lot of different factors, but I feel that new media and the interest in food that has been growing and continues to grow, that is a new thing. I think that there is some kind of dynamism between them that creates a very interesting moment for us today.
Mm-hmm. And so you don't think, I mean, clearly with 1.7 million readers or whatever the ultimate number is, this isn't going anywhere. This sort of food magazine that you pick up
in the supermarket,
grocery store line and get inspired to do something with what's in your basket or to pick up a few other things ain't going anywhere anytime soon.
No. And I mean, I think people are, they love the magazine on Twitter. They love it on, you know, Pinterest. It's just, it's another opportunity to interact. I don't think cookbooks are going anywhere. People absolutely are still going gaga for cookbooks. I think hard copy magazines have a place. And I think people feel more empowered to cook. And I think that the internet has a lot to do with that.
Mm-hmm. And at the same time, the driving force, the identification with the personality, the fact that Rachel Ray is staring, smiling back at me on this cover, somehow just distinguishes or makes a touch point for people to pick up and engage this over at other things. Although there's a lot of new magazines going on too in food. It's interesting.
Yes. I mean, there's Lucky Peach. People want to engage with David Chang. He's not smiling on the cover.
No, he's
his brand,
pulling his hair out.
Yeah, he's frowning and swearing. Yeah. But his brand is very potent.
Totally.
And, you know, it would be an interesting, maybe someone at NYU Food Studies can do a comparison between the David Changs of the food celebrity world and the Rachel Rays.
Right. But they are both about possibilities, you know. They are, I mean, as you mentioned, this sort of multifactorial?
Sure.
I don't know if there's a thing about food that just is engaging people at every level, people who would never be interested even before. One of the amazing things I think about Dave Chang and the way people identify with him is many of those people, they would never pick up this magazine, and yet they're still really interested and passionate about food in some ways.
Yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon, and I'm thinking about the fact that this woman is in her early 40s and she has created a media empire, and enough so that she's employing many amazing people.
Right.
And I've joined them, and it's just, you know, it's just wonderful to see how she's bringing cooking into American homes, because people pick up the magazine because they love her, but they keep picking it up because the recipes are really great.
In the last couple of minutes we have, do you have ideas for future features that you want to explore, that you're pitching?
I do.
What do you think is should
not,
be there?
I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say,
or just even topics that you think need to be more present in some of the food media out there?
I'll tell you, I'm still, you know, I still am trying to be on my best behavior, so I'll tell you off the air. However, next time we meet up, if one of them comes to fruition, I will tell the world.
Okay. Let's then spend the last couple of minutes talking about any experiences that I should be knowing about that you've eaten recently around town here in New York.
Well, can I tell you about something in Montreal? It's
of
a dish
course,
that I think you would absolutely love. Okay, so Montreal is one of my favorite places in the world, and I hope that when I die, I go to Montreal in the summertime. And Joe Beef just opened a wine bar. It's called Le Vin Papillon. And they served me a dish, and I was like, this is a brilliant mishmash of Israeli Jewish food and Ashkenazi, Eastern European Jewish food. It was a roasted cauliflower lobe covered with gribnis, which is fried chicken fat, skin, or chicken skin. And I was just, I was talking to Fred, who's one of the owners, and I said, Fred, do you realize this is a brilliant Jewish mashup? And he said, no, you just like how it tastes. It turns out that one of the managers has traveled many times to Tel Aviv, and she knew exactly what it was. And her boyfriend is the chef, and I believe that actually she's a part owner. I think that she was whispering in his ear, but it was one of the most surprising things that I ate this summer.
Roasted cauliflower covered in gribbiness, basically. Yes, okay. Yes. It was funny. In a yakitori place in Japan, I was served, we began the meal with a pile of crunchy salted fried chicken skin. Maybe gribness is the new bacon or something. Maybe
it's the old bacon, Mitchell. It's the biblical bacon.
All right. And maybe you'll find that recipe in the pages of an upcoming issue of Every Day with Rachel Ray magazine, and maybe you won't. Regardless, we'll be looking forward to your contributions in the future to this great publication. Thank you for joining us, Gabriella.
Thank you for having me.
Always nice to have you here. Next week, we are going to Japan. I brought my recorder with me, and I went with a chef and a wholesaler through the Tsukiji Fish Market, the largest fish market in the world, walking through places that people aren't allowed. We were kind of sneaky, and so I hope you'll tune in and come with me and my friends through the incredible, almost undescribable odyssey that is the Tsukiji Fish Market next week. In the meantime, cook something for dinner. Make it fat. Make it yummo.
Yes.
You're listening to Taste Matters. Thanks.
Nice.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.